Everyone. We are ready. First, let me say that this morning, Judge Duncan and I are pleased to have Judge Osteen with us. He's a friend from Middle District, isn't he?
Middle District. Correct.
Middle District, North Carolina. Pleased to have you with us this morning.
Thank you, Judge Chad.
We're ready for argument in the first case, Wyoke Technology versus Republic of Iraq. Mr. Riley?
Good morning, Your Honor.
Good morning.
Craig Riley here for the Republic of Iraq. May it please the court. The district court erred when denying Iraq's motion to dismiss for lack of subject matter jurisdiction. Under the FISA.
Could you speak a little more directly into the mic?
Sorry, Your Honor.
Thank you.
I will. I was in fact hearing an echo back here. I thought I was speaking too loudly. Something I have been criticized for.
We'll let you know.
Thank you, Your Honor. Under the FISA, a foreign state shall be immune except as provided in the FISA. Here, Wyoke invoked the commercial activities exceptions to the FISA, but Iraq engaged in no commercial conduct.
Let me ask you.
Yes, Your Honor.
I first want to address, have you addressed, how do we have jurisdiction in this case to hear the subject matter issue? Subject matter jurisdiction issue. And along those lines, let me ask you this much. If you were to lose on that question here, then do you consider that you cannot raise subject matter jurisdiction again in this case in the D.C. Circuit? Are you bound by our determination on subject matter?
I guess you've asked me two questions, and if
I'll answer either and both.
Yes, I will answer both, and if I could answer the first one.
Sure.
We respectfully submit that this court does have appellate jurisdiction, and we believe it attached immediately because this was an immediately appealable order, and it attached where and when that order was entered.
I know. The question is, why do we have subject matter jurisdiction to decide it now? And if we do have jurisdiction, why prudentially would we decide it, not just dismiss it for prudential reasons? I'm trying to figure out, as probably you can figure, what would be the effect of a ruling by this circuit on the question of subject matter jurisdiction in this case. Would it bind you in the D.C. Circuit? Would it bind the D.C. Circuit?
Well, could the D.C. Circuit even hear it, an appeal from a district court in another circuit?
Well, that's one of the issues that was addressed.
But I'm not asking that question. That's another question. I want you to answer that, too, but I want you to answer my question.
Mm-hmm.
What would be the effect on you as a litigant and on the D.C. Circuit of our ruling on subject matter jurisdiction?
If this court ruled that there was subject matter jurisdiction sufficient to go forward on the merits of the case, much as if it was going back to the Eastern District, this court would return to the district court now in the District of Columbia, and the District of Columbia court would treat that as an interlocutory ruling, and perhaps even law of the case.
But let me ask you this. If you lost and said there is subject matter jurisdiction in this case, would you feel that you are bound by this decision, that you could not argue to the court in the District of Columbia that there was no subject matter jurisdiction?
I would be bound by it in the same sense as the law of the case would be if this case was sent back to the Eastern District. And I accept the court's point.
But my point is, when does subject matter jurisdiction ever control by law of the case? It is in one circuit, I understand, because that's a circuit decision. But I'm asked, doesn't each court have its own obligation to decide subject matter jurisdiction?
Yes. It's something that can be raised at any time, I think, in any way. And
Sua sponte.
Yes, I agree. And what would occur, I think, here, for example, Your Honor, if on the allegations of the complaint, this court were to find subject matter jurisdiction, but we were then returned to a district court, whether in this circuit or outside this circuit, and the facts did not pan out as alleged, and it was revealed on the factual record that there was no subject matter jurisdiction.
What if there's no discovery of new fact that in any way changes the scenario? Do you consider that you would be bound through all the way through the Court of Appeals for the District of Columbia that you could not raise subject matter jurisdiction again?
If I'm understanding the question correctly, Your Honor, that this is intended as my chance to raise that issue. And I think that if you were to decide...
That's just what I need to know. Do you think this is your only chance through the course of this litigation, even in the other circuit, to raise subject matter jurisdiction?
No, Your Honor, but only in the sense that I explained it, because I don't mean to disrespect this court's ruling or show that this is anything other than...
And what value is a ruling from this court if you don't think you're bound by it and you could raise it again? What value is a ruling by this court?
Optimistically, Your Honor, I'm hoping you rule in my favor.
I'll tell you if you were to lose.
I understand, Your Honor.
Clear that it wouldn't be law of the case. Mm-hmm. Is it? I mean, I don't quite... Flipping the question, mm-hmm. What prudential concerns would counsel us not to hear an appeal from a district court in the circuit?
I'm sorry, Your Honor, if I...
I'm a little concerned about the law of the case and what would happen if a district court ruling on an issue went to an appellate court in another circuit. They would not be able to hear that, would they? They can't review an appeal from a district court in another circuit. Isn't that one of the things that counsels against not dismissing for lack of jurisdiction? Which you started out by saying that you think we have.
I think this court does. I think a similar factual situation presented itself in the Technosteel case.
Well, let me ask you this. Mm-hmm. But the question, that might be an exception to the general rule, mm-hmm. if it's something that comports with whatever that sort of amorphous theory of law of the case is. But isn't subject matter jurisdiction always open to being questioned by the parties and certainly by the court, any court?
Yes, Your Honor.
Doesn't that strike a different balance? Not if there's some other question, like arbitration, that you can never get heard, but subject matter jurisdiction, a decision by this court won't end a question of the existence of subject matter jurisdiction in this case, will it? It will if any case that stays in the Fourth Circuit, but not if it's in the D.C. Circuit. Our decision on subject matter jurisdiction won't bind the D.C. Circuit in any way on subject matter jurisdiction, will it?
Ultimately, when the facts are reviewed, no, it would not. Because the review, again, as presented here, is on the allegations of the complaint because they were assumed to be true by the district judge.
So then is this a premature determination of subject matter jurisdiction?
No, Your Honor. In fact, in FISA cases, this is an important procedural protection for the foreign sovereign state to immediately appeal and contest the assertion of subject matter jurisdiction.
But where would it go? Where would the ruling go in the D.C., in the District of Columbia? It could not go to the District of Columbia Circuit, could it? Under 1294, I mean, the district court could not hear an appeal from a district court in this circuit.
That is correct, Your Honor. And that, I think,
But the subject matter of that appeal mm-hmm. could be heard. The subject matter, which is whether or not there's subject matter jurisdiction, that issue could be raised again, couldn't it?
Yes, as it remains an issue throughout the case. The procedural step here in the FISA, however, is to permit the foreign sovereign to contest it on an immediate appeal so that the value of the immunity is not lost.
Speaking of which, let me ask you this question. What if the D.C. Circuit took a different view of what commercial activity was and what was sufficient for jurisdiction or for lack of jurisdiction than the Fourth Circuit? Could it be that we would that one circuit would decide there is subject matter jurisdiction and then the case would be transferred to another circuit where on the same facts that circuit would say there is no jurisdiction? Who would control then?
If I may add a fact to the hypothetical, Your Honor.
Well, just answer it first.
All right. I think
you understand my point. What if courts look at the jurisdictional issue, subject matter jurisdiction, differently? Conflict hadn't been settled by the Supreme Court yet. They just look at it differently.
Yes.
And one court of appeals would take it and under that set of facts decide under their determination, their precedent, there is jurisdiction. But clearly under the other circuits, there is not.
Right.
Who would what would that net us?
I don't think, for example, the D.C. Circuit would then be in a position to review your appellate decision here.
He would have to have a separate action, though. It would not be this action, the action that was brought in this case. It would have to be a different action.
Well, if I may suggest, I don't believe so, because what...
Because the case itself has been transferred properly. That case exists in that circuit.
Yes, it does. Yes, it does. And that, again, is what happened in Technosteel.
Yeah, but I'm talking about the scenario I gave you.
Yes.
So that then you would have a determination by one circuit that there is jurisdiction on a case that is properly in another circuit. Which circuit would think under those very same facts there is no subject matter jurisdiction? What happens then?
I think the hypothetical as you've posed it, Your Honor, is an insoluble problem. If I may add a factor to it, though, is that this court's ruling is on the allegations made in the complaint.
I'm talking about a general rule. Just take my hypothetical. Now, what if on the facts as asserted in the complaint, one circuit would have jurisdiction and one circuit would say there is no jurisdiction? Doesn't that caution for no determination on an interlocutory appeal, and instead let the court, which properly has the case, deal with subject matter there? By the way, didn't you appeal subject? Did you not appeal this to the D.C. Circuit?
Yes, Your Honor.
You've already appealed the subject matter question to the D.C. Circuit.
We did. We filed a notice of appeal in the District of Columbia
District
Court. Just as protective
court. Matter. Is that what you did?
I'm sorry?
Is it to protect your position?
As a precaution, Your Honor. This is a perplexing issue. And certainly we appreciated the opportunity to submit additional briefing to the court. Both sides, as we examined it under Technosteel, it appeared to us as if the distinctions between this case and Technosteel would not make a difference as to which court had appellate jurisdiction.
Isn't a distinction in Technosteel, unlike subject matter jurisdiction, the issue there would be without appeal if it were not heard in the Fourth Circuit?
And I understand that, and I think that
you may
that
not
actually,
think that distinguishes it enough, but that is clearly a distinguishing factor.
It certainly frames the issue in a way that I think presents a different issue than what was presented in Technosteel, which was there was not this question about subject matter jurisdiction. Although I think in arbitration cases there may be some.
We actually do, though, have Supreme Court case law looking at precisely the question of the law of the case, don't we?
The Christensen?
It would have to be clearly erroneous, manifest injustice, and clearly erroneous with respect to subject matter jurisdiction.
There are standards under which the law of the case is binding and sort of sticks with the case regardless of the court. I encounter this from time to time at the district court level, where in the Eastern District we used to not have a single judge assigned. We would get a ruling from Judge Williams at one point.
And I also would like to ask a question on the merits at some point.
Let me ask one last question on this.
Yes, Your Honor.
Do you think the law as it stands now is that if one circuit decided there is subject matter jurisdiction, but the case has been transferred to a second circuit, which under the same facts would find there absolutely is no subject matter jurisdiction under the precedent of that second circuit, you think then the law of the case would say the second, the accepting circuit would have to find subject matter jurisdiction or have to proceed as if there were subject matter jurisdiction?
No, Your Honor, because the limits of the law of the case doctrine are always, it's prudential, it's a cautionary, it's a savings of judicial economy, parties in litigants, of not rehashing things that have been settled that ought to remain settled. But something, as you point out, for subject matter jurisdiction, it's always subject to review. We believe it would be reviewed as the case goes on, particularly if the facts don't pan out as the allegations have set forth.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Yes.
Talk to me, please, a little bit about the Foreign Sovereign Immunities Act, and can you point to any case law that uses foreign law in making a substantive determination? I understand that under the contract, Iraqi law controls, but with respect to the applicability of the immunity provisions, what authority do you have for the proposition that foreign law controls in that instance?
Your Honor, we pointed to the Bansek case from the United States Supreme Court. And in that case, it stated specifically that the determination of a party's status was determined by the law under which that entity was created, which in this instance would be the law of Iraq. In that case, it was the law of Cuba. And the federal courts must start with the presumption that separate juridical entities, as created under foreign law, are normally to be treated independent from one another when they are litigants in federal court. There are exceptions that the Bansek court set forth, but neither exception was alleged or proven below. Whether the court can determine, and I'll note for the court that my time
you
has...
You can continue. We asked a lot of questions. I'll give you a few more minutes.
Thank you very much, Your Honor. To determine whether to set aside that presumption of separate juridical status as established by foreign law will be in great part factual. And
but
the burden of.
But there's a threshold question as to, you start with the general assumption that that a foreign entity enjoys immunity. The only way to assert jurisdiction at all is through an exception to the Foreign Sovereign Immunity Act. So my question is, for that threshold inquiry to get even into the dispute between the parties, what authority do you have for the proposition that the law of the foreign sovereign control?
Two, Your Honor, and both are found in the Bansek case, but then also in the legislative history cited by that court. In the Bansek case, the U.S. Supreme Court said specifically that this issue is not controlled by the FISA, it's not controlled by the statute, and looked to the law of the place where the juridical entity was created, in that case, the law of Cuba, said, and the Supreme Court also directed that the parties, that the governmental entity's separate juridical state is presumptively determined by foreign law. And this discussion is at pages 627 to 628 of the U.S. Supreme Court ruling. The FISA
But
legislative
immunity
history.
Is a question of subject matter jurisdiction, which is determined by Congress, and the source for determining sovereign immunity is the Act.
Yes, but one of the things that Congress made clear when enacting the FISA was, first, that the FISA does not control the attribution of liability, and second, the FISA does not control questions of, and I'm quoting, whether the proper entity of a foreign state has been sued. Citing that language, the U.S. Supreme Court said in Bansek that we must then look to the law that created the entity, in that case the law of Cuba, in this case the law of Iraq. And then, but the distinctions made in the FISA for what's a political subdivision, what's an agency or instrumentality, are procedural rulings that govern an entity's procedural rights under the FISA. For example, whether there's been proper service and whether the service procedures that apply to a political subdivision, which are different than and more strict than those that apply to an agency or instrumentality, have been followed. The core functions test, or governmental functions test, which the U.S. Supreme Court rejected the Bansek case, and this is discussed in their footnote 27 in the opinion, made it very clear that you do not apply a core functions or governmental functions test under the FISA to determine whether you've got the right person in court. That the district judge in the Bansek case had analyzed it as a proper party or standing issue, and had ruled as follows, and this is quoted in the Supreme Court decision, that the bank...
I am familiar with that. Thank you. Okay. I think I've explored the limits of my question.
Okay.
One quick one. And the district court's opinion, the district court stated that the MOD is inextricably... lack of responsibility for contracts entered into by the MOD is inextricably bound up in the ultimate merits of the case and cannot be resolved within the present posture of the case. What effect does that finding have on your contention that the law of the case will apply when the district court has, in essence, declined to make a finding at this procedural stage of the case, very briefly.
I think, Your Honor, that a ruling that this is inextricably bound up with the merits is an error, and we analyzed it for the court under the Robinson case, I think decided by the Second Circuit, which said notwithstanding that there may be some overlap between the merits adjudication and these initial procedural rulings, that the court is the district court is required, and as this court teaches in the Velasco case, is required to conduct a sufficient factual investigation to make sure it has subject matter jurisdiction before moving to the merits. That's one of the benefits of the Foreign Sovereign Immunity Act that is lost if you defer these issues to the adjudication on the merits. So procedurally, the district court is bound to make a sufficient factual inquiry at the threshold
so
to determine.
So if we affirm the district court, are you bound by that in the D.C. Circuit?
I think, again, since the district court simply assumed that the allegations made in the complaint would be assumed to be true for the purposes of asserting jurisdiction, that the ruling of if a ruling were to affirm that, it would go no farther than to say that on the allegations made, that is sufficient. We've, of course, challenged the sufficiency of those allegations. Under this court's decision in Rux, R-U-X, you have to plead more than just the conclusory assertions that I have a contract, the state of Iraq is obligated to pay me.
Thank you for answering my question. Thank you.
You reserved some time. I'm going to lie.
Yes, I have, Your Honor. Thank you
very much. Mr. Pavich. Did I get your name right?
You got the last name right and pronounced it correctly, Your Honor. It's Pavich. Good morning, Your Honor.
Good morning.
And I have a sneaking suspicion of what's going to be, what I'll be encountering in the next few seconds.
You can go right to it if you want to. Let me ask the question of you this way, because I'm interested. We all are, but I want to explore the jurisdictional issue. If we were to find, if the Fourth Circuit were to find that there is no subject matter jurisdiction in this case, then are you bound to dismiss your action in the D.C. Circuit?
If this court were to find that the
there is no
lower court had erred, that there, it would reverse the lower court
if we were to find,
subject matter jurisdiction.
If we were to find there is no subject matter jurisdiction at the district court level, as far as we're concerned as the Fourth Circuit, are you then compelled to dismiss your case in the district court?
Yes, the case would be over. That would be a final ruling, and we would be bound by it. Yes, sir.
And what is there a ruling in the D.C.? Is there some case law in the D.C. Circuit that informs you of that? That on subject matter jurisdiction, they would be bound by a determination by us?
That's obviously a different question. We would be bound by your determination that there is no subject matter jurisdiction in this case. We would be bound by that. Yes. The question, you've put to me, is a much different question.
Right.
And I think, I think the answer to that.
So if you refiled a case with the same facts in the D.C. Circuit, you wouldn't be bound by our determination?
Res judicata. We'd be bound. We would not be able to refile the case, Your Honor.
So you think the determination on subject matter here does control the D.C. Circuit?
It controls us, Your Honor.
Right.
It controls us. It has nothing to do with the D.C. Circuit. It controls this case. It controls us.
I understand.
And so
you would find it binding on a party. Our determination would be binding on a party.
That's correct. And I think it would be anomalous if we would be bound by it and not the defendant, for example. If this court were to affirm. And we were then, of course, to find ourselves for the remainder of the case at the D.C. Circuit, having been transferred there, they also would be bound by this court's ruling, insofar as we believe is clearly the law of the case, that there has been a conclusive ruling that has enabled the defendant to appeal this case to this court.
Let me ask you this. Back to my hypothetical, what if the circuits had different rules for subject matter jurisdiction under similar facts? Let's just say under this case, if one circuit found that some activity was enough to grant immunity, But the other circuit had precedent that that activity was not enough to grant immunity. Then would determination by the First Circuit, here, bind the Second with different rules on subject matter jurisdiction?
No, it would not. Different circuits can rule differently, as happens regularly, on perhaps even the same facts.
Well, if that's the case, then why wouldn't it caution for the court that does not have the ultimate decision in the case not deciding subject matter jurisdiction? Because what bearing would it have?
Because this court does have the ultimate jurisdiction in this case. This is an appeal of an interlocutory order under the Foreign Sovereign Immunity Act, which has, in order to meet the requirements of the collateral order rule, it must be a conclusive ruling. And that conclusive ruling on the issue of subject matter jurisdiction of the Foreign Sovereign Immunity Act has been made by this court. Now, what are the alternatives that might be available if this court were to affirm the trial court and we were to find ourselves in the D.C. Circuit Court? I think the D.C. Circuit has identified those alternatives. There are two: a motion to reconsider or a motion to retransfer. A motion to retransfer would be made. If that were done, we would be retransferring it back to Judge Trenga, which would then bring us back up here on exactly the same briefs, on exactly the same issues. That's one alternative that the D.C. court has identified. The other is to make the motion for reconsideration. But the law of the case would apply. There has to be some solid basis for a motion to reconsider.
And the law of the case.
Some new facts. I'm sorry, Your Honor.
The law of the case, presenting an issue as the law of the case, significantly changes the standard under which the second court considers it, doesn't it? It has to be clearly erroneous in order to overcome the law of the case.
Well, I think that if for example, there had been a motion to reconsider in front of Judge Trenga, mm-hmm. That burden would be no greater.
Mm-hmm.
It would be the same burden. Mm-hmm. So that motion to reconsider, even though this might be considered the law of the case, a motion to reconsider could still open that, but it would be under the same standard that would be necessary here, no greater than that.
But I thought the question was law of the case as it would apply in the other circuit.
When you're confronted with a finding, with a finding that constitutes the law of the case.
Yes.
In order to overcome that, the level of deference is greater.
But they do the same thing if they were trying to appeal it in front of Judge Trenga. In other words, they have the option to file a motion to reconsider.
Okay, but that really.
I'm sorry.
I wasn't making that distinction. I was asking about the court in a different jurisdiction.
Yes, I'm talking about the D.C. court.
Yes.
The D.C. court has identified as a possible course here two possible courses. If the court, and that is a motion to retransfer this case, or a motion to reconsider in front of the D.C. Circuit.
I thought the question was, and if it wasn't, then I'll ask it. In your opinion, does law of the case from the Fourth Circuit affect the way the D.C. Circuit would look at subject matter jurisdiction?
Yes.
I think it would look at it in the same way as the trial court in the EDDA, and that is that the law of the case does not bind the D.C. Circuit to bar it from considering a motion to reconsider.
The question is the lens through which, or at least my question.
That's my question too.
The lens through which the receiving court reviews that issue. When a subsequent court gets a determination by a prior court that has established the law of the case, the standard of review is different.
Different than
looking at it as though the law of the case had not been established.
And I'm trying to answer that, and I guess we're having a problem in my answering your question, and I apologize.
Yes, the question.
It sees it no differently than would Judge Trenga, who's been confronted with a motion to reconsider.
I'm going to ask my question. Maybe this will get an answer. Would the D.C. courts give any deference whatsoever to the fact that the subject matter jurisdiction issue had already been decided in the Fourth Circuit?
Yes. Yes, absolutely.
Let me ask a distinction between this case and the Technosteel case. In Technosteel, wasn't the party that wanted to appeal was not the party making the motion to transfer, correct? So in other words, in Technosteel, the party that made the motion to transfer took a step to try to eliminate appeal of the arbitration award. Is that correct?
I think that's correct. They were trying
to. We don't have that in this case, do we? In the party that is appealing, also the party that moved to transfer?
That's correct.
Did the other side move to stay the court order? The transfer order?
Well, all proceedings have been stayed at the D.C. Court.
No, I'm talking about at the Virginia court.
I don't know the answer to that.
You don't know?
I don't know. Virginia.
So we're set up in this situation that the party that's bringing this appeal is the same party that, to my recollection, did not ask for a stay at the district court in Virginia and also sought transfer of the case to D.C. Is that correct?
I believe that Iraq.
Well, you didn't ask for the case to be transferred, did you?
No. We opposed the motion to transfer.
All right. Yeah. Thank you.
Can you help me with my question regarding case law that utilizes foreign law in making the initial substantive determination with respect to whether immunity exists under the Act?
Right. In order to determine whether or not a court has subject matter jurisdiction under the FSIA. It is American law, the FSIA, that has to be, that is determinative. We look at the FSIA and its provisions in order to determine whether we have met the burden of establishing subject matter jurisdiction. It is not a merits issue.
And that's the distinction you would make with respect to Van Zandt, the case that your colleague relied upon?
Yes. The Supreme Court case that we've just been discussed, involved merits. It did not involve subject matter jurisdiction. That went to the merits of whether or not an instrumentality, namely a bank, would be held accountable for the actions of the sovereign that were completely unconnected to the transaction at issue. That went to the merits. That case did not involve an analysis of subject matter jurisdiction. Subject matter jurisdiction is an analysis that's taken under American law, the interpretation of the FSIA. When you get to the merits, as we've done in this case with the second motion that was filed by the defendant, and as the court found, the question of whether Iraq is responsible for a contract that was signed on behalf of Iraq by the Ministry of Defense goes to the merits. And there we must look to the merits issue. It's proper to look at Iraqi law, but on the initial analysis, Iraqi law is not determinative or even relevant.
Can I ask a little bit about the commercial activities exceptions and the actions that qualify? And the district court found that you established all three.
That's correct.
I had a couple of problems with let's talk about them, the direct effect in the United States.
The statute does not require that the direct effect be commercial, and that is a suggestion that's been made by the defendant here. A direct effect simply means a direct effect that is foreseeable and immediate. We've identified a direct effect that is commercial, an enormous financial loss to the company, but goes way beyond commercial direct effects. We've named two in particular. One, a wrongful death that was immediately followed as a result of the breach of contract, and the jeopardy that the IMERP project was put into by the failure to pay our contract and the question of whether we would be able to perform on that contract, because the IMERP program was central to U.S. foreign policy and had to direct, therefore, the breach of that contract and the jeopardy that IMERP was placed into as a result of that breach had a direct effect on the United States
As I understand it, in order for an effect to be direct, it has to be an immediate consequence of the activity. And are you saying that
all three were
the deaths were an immediate consequence of the defendant's activity?
The loss of the commercial loss of $24, $25 million. The death, because of the breach, Dale Stoffel was required to travel to Iraq for a meeting in December of 2004 in order to resolve the impasse.
But you've already become somewhat indirect.
I don't know that the Supreme Court has put a timetable on immediate. I believe that there was no intervening cause. It was, the Supreme Court said it should be, it need not even be foreseeable. I think that was where the term immediate came in. The Supreme Court was rejecting the idea that the effect should be foreseeable, but that it should be immediate. No time frame was given to that. We believe we suggested immediacy here, consistent with what other courts have found. But on those three bases, we feel we've met the direct effects requirement. Of course, we've met the other two.
Which do you think is the strongest of those three?
On direct effect or the three commercial activities?
The three commercial activities.
I think it's, personally, I would say number two. There was here activity taken in the United States in connection with an activity of the foreign government outside the United States. But I also feel that number one is also very clear under the contract. It's a close call between one and two. Direct effect requires the court to consider things that are unusual, to say the least, to find direct effect. But I believe we do meet direct effect. One and two, I think, are close. The agency is established by the contract and by the letters and commissions that were attached and signed at the same time.
Well, the contract itself, didn't the contract clearly contemplate auction of equipment on a worldwide basis such that activity within the United States? It's alleged in the complaint, but it would have also been contemplated by the parties, at least in a general fashion.
Absolutely. And that there would have been a lot of accounting, a lot of work that would have to be done in the United States, communications to potential customers. All of that was contemplated, having been done in the United States. There was no really secure place in Iraq at that time for us to carry out those kinds of activities.
Back up to your question about, or I thought I understood your statement that Iraqi law was really irrelevant to some part of the jurisdictional analysis. Doesn't the presumption that's set out in the bank check case arise originally from the way the foreign sovereign has set up the instrumentality such that Iraqi law is at least relevant to the extent determination is made that the presumption arises? Is that correct or incorrect in your mind?
No, Your Honor, I believe that's incorrect because we have to, and I say it's incorrect in this context. It's a two-step process. The first step is to determine whether or not there is subject matter jurisdiction under the Foreign Sovereign Immunity Act. That is a question that is exclusively an interpretation of the Foreign Sovereign Immunity Act and, for example, the court found that a political subdivision, there was no distinction to be made in the Foreign Sovereign Immunity Act between a sovereign and a political subdivision. Iraq admits that a political subdivision is, for purposes of the Sovereign Immunity Act, a sovereign, as is the government of Iraq.
Tell me your view of the presumption, then, that the court talked about.
It comes into the second step. That is the merits. Because when they filed their motion saying that Iraq was not a proper party, that went to the merits, as to whether or not Iraq could be held responsible for a contract signed by its political subdivision. That goes to the merits. It was the merits analysis that the Supreme Court was undertaking when it said that foreign law, there's a presumption on that issue, on that second issue, and that's why we had to look at the affidavit that was supplied by Iraq. On that second step, which gets to the merits, there's a presumption that we should give respect to those political subdivisions and juridical entities that are taken. But even that presumption can be overcome under certain circumstances, and that's where you get into the core functions analysis. But the Iraqi law only comes in that second step, Your Honor, when we get to the merits. When we're analyzing the Foreign Sovereign Immunity Act for purposes of jurisdiction, we don't allow a sovereign to define itself in such a way that it would make the foreign that would negate the act. For example, you might get into a position that the invasion of Kuwait was taken, was undertaken by the MOD and Iraq, because the MOD is a separate juridical entity, has no responsibility for the invasion of Kuwait, because that was undertaken by an entity that, for which Iraq is not responsible.
You, so in your mind, on the jurisdictional question, not the question of whether or not you sued the proper party or not, Iraqi law is irrelevant.
That's right.
Just the question of whether or not there's activity being conducted under the act that would bring it under the act.
Right. Is this a sovereign? And if this is a sovereign, taken actions, commercial activity actions that bring it within the act. That has to be interpreted under U.S. law. That's correct.
The district court seemed to indicate, and Judge O.C. read part of that order, this is jurisdiction again, that he would deny the motion to dismiss the posture of the case because some of the facts were too tied into the merits.
Right. That was the second step, Your Honor.
Well, let me ask you this much. Do you think our ruling on subject matter jurisdiction is controlling only as to the facts are known now? In other words, if facts were discovered, could subject matter jurisdiction issue be raised again by the other side, if you were to win?
If we were to win, I believe that the finding has been conclusive. We're looking at the complaint itself. This is a 12B motion that has to accept as true the allegations of the complaint.
Facts were developed, then subject matter could be raised again.
Only to the extent, I think, that we get to the merits and it is determined by the court that Iraq is not responsible for the conduct or for the activities undertaken by the MOD. That's that second step. That goes to the merits. It doesn't touch that first finding, which is based on the allegations of the complaint itself, which must be taken as true as long as they're plausible.
So that's summary judgment.
Yes. That's correct.
Yeah, but I was going to, that would be summary judgment. My question would be, if you were to get a favorable ruling from this court, that subject matter jurisdiction is subject to challenge again in this litigation at some point. Do you think that?
I don't believe so, Your Honor.
You don't believe so?
Because there are no new facts that would be introduced. Motion for summary judgment.
So you think the district court did say, based on the facts as I see them in the complaint, there is jurisdiction?
Absolutely. No question about it. It then went on to the second step, because the first motion that was filed by Iraq simply focused on subject matter jurisdiction. They then filed a second motion stating that we basically sued the wrong party. That went to the merits. The court clearly ruled that it found subject matter jurisdiction because the allegations of our complaint, the plausible allegations of our complaint, not looking outside the four corners of the complaint,
but you think then
met the requirements of the FSIA.
You think our decision here is solely on whether or not on a 12B6 motion?
That's correct.
And so that
that's correct.
If the case is properly transferred to the D.C. courts,
yes,
then any fact added to the complaint would again raise the question of subject matter jurisdiction?
No.
Why
no, that would be a summary judgment. That would be a fact that would go to on the issue of summary judgment. In fact, Your Honor, in looking at the pleadings, we took the position had waived jurisdiction.
No, but I'm going to ask you this question. But why can't a fact come up after a 12B6 motion? Isn't it possible for a fact to come up in litigation that shows there is no subject matter jurisdiction?
I'm having trouble conceding, Your Honor, of what fact could be. We've alleged we made certain allegations. The court looks at the complaint in order to determine.
I know that, but what happens if then in discovery a fact comes up that something you allege that's critical to subject matter jurisdiction on a 12B6 is just absolutely not true?
Summary judgment. For example, if it turns out that this contract that they had no authority to sign the contract on behalf of anyone, that it was a forgery. For example, and they can bring in facts of their cases that hold that, or if they allege that the
let's just say this: what if you allege there's a commercial activity that takes it out? What in a case exactly like this in a hypothetical, it turns out that allegation is absolutely not correct. It's not true. It's just, wouldn't that be a subject matter jurisdiction?
No, that's a fact issue, Your Honor. That is not a 12B6. That's a Rule 56.
I'm talking about after 12B6. If you are correct in the motion to deny for lack of subject matter jurisdiction, if you were to win on that issue, what if completely subsequent to that, But soon thereafter, there's a fact in discovery that is found to absolutely point out that one of your critical linchpins in your complaint is not true. Would that not, that would go to subject matter jurisdiction, wouldn't it?
No, it wouldn't. It would be a summary judgment on the, because they would then have established that our facts, the facts are incorrect. But for purposes, for the purposes of analyzing under 12b-6, you have to accept as true the facts that we have plausibly alleged. If you're going to attack those facts affirmatively from something outside the complaint,
I'm giving you that. You're saying that once subject matter jurisdiction attaches by way of denying a motion to dismiss, that then subject matter jurisdiction exists for the entire case? Has to exist for the entire case?
It has to exist unless there's a motion to reconsider to point out that the court was wrong based on the facts of the complaint and its analysis. Yes, to that extent. If they're going to bring in outside affirmative facts to challenge what we've said, then it's no longer a 12b-6 because you're no longer accepting as true what we've alleged.
In some circumstances, though, a court can have some discovery to decide jurisdiction.
Yes, it's called jurisdictional discovery, which they did not request in this case, nor did the court feel was necessary. Yes, absolutely.
But I just want to be sure that I understand your position on this. If a person asserts in their complaint allegations sufficient for 12b-6 to establish subject matter jurisdiction,
right,
what happens if the next day it is undisputed that some of those alleged facts, which are critical to jurisdiction, are just not true? Subject matter jurisdiction still is there?
Yes, because because you're not attacking subject matter jurisdiction.
Yes, you are. That's what I'm doing.
No, I don't believe that you can in that way, Your Honor, respectfully, because when you're attacking the complaint based on an affirmative matter, because you're talking about affirmative matter.
No, wait a second. But what you're saying then is a court looks, we're talking about lenses. A court looks through the lens of 12b-6 and says, I must accept everything you say to be true.
Yeah.
And I accept that. And under those facts, which I accept under 12b-6, there is subject matter jurisdiction.
Yeah.
But the next day, there's undisputed evidence that some of those allegations are not correct. They're just incorrect.
Yes.
The court can't then revisit subject matter jurisdiction?
It can.
I think they would have to, wouldn't they?
No. It would at that point entertain a motion for summary judgment and find that
Why wouldn't the court just say?
Because the sufficiency of the complaint is not being attacked.
No, but the court.
You were attacking the complaint as being
wrong on the
facts.
Why couldn't the court at that point just say, I rule for you on 12b-6 because under those allegations there would be subject matter jurisdiction. But it's now come to my attention that some of those allegations are absolutely not correct. Sua sponte, I'm raising subject matter jurisdiction. Tell me, parties, why I have subject matter jurisdiction this
day. Your Honor, respectfully, that's not subject matter jurisdiction. You have now taken this from a 12b-6, which accepts the facts as true, and have found,
and I'm
you have
you,
found
no,
the facts
no, no,
to be
I'm
true.
No, I'm giving you that.
No.
You haven't found any facts to be true.
But Your Honor, you have found. You found a fact to be true that contradicts our complaint. That's a motion. You've just said that the next day a fact is brought to me. I have now found that to be true because I now know that what you said is false.
What if you take judicial notice that something comes into purview of judicial notice the next day? I'm just asking you the general question of, A court can always sua sponte raise subject matter jurisdiction. You don't think a court can do that?
It can.
But not through the lens of 12b-6.
Exactly.
I'm giving you 12b-6. I'm not asking about 12b-6. I've said I'm giving you that. I said if you win on this, and so after that ruling, after the lens of 12b-6, that's settled, then immediately thereafter, something comes as clear knowledge to the court that proves that. Because you get the benefit of the doubt on the 12b-6, correct? What you assert,
yes,
we take as true.
That's correct.
What if we find, after we've ruled, then the court that's handling the case finds that one of those assertions is just not true?
Then you have found, that's summary judgment. You have found a fact. You made a finding of fact, Your Honor.
The court does not have to file summary judgment. The court just can raise sua sponte subject matter jurisdiction. The court doesn't have to file summary judgment. I mean,
The court has the power at that point to invite the parties to brief the issue of,
right,
of whether or not here summary judgment is appropriate because of facts that are outside the complaint. The court certainly has the power.
No, I don't think that's right. I think the court would just say, I believe I don't have subject matter jurisdiction, and I would like for you to argue to me why I do. It didn't have anything to do with summary judgment. You think it has to be summary judgment?
It has everything to do with summary judgment. Here,
and the court has to use summary judgment. The court has to use the vehicle of summary judgment to determine sua sponte whether or not it has subject matter jurisdiction?
No. No, the court can look at the complaint. The court can look at the complaint and determine whether it has subject matter jurisdiction.
No, just as the you're judge past 12b-6, though. I mean, you're past 12b-6 in the litigation. Can you envision that after 12b-6, it could come obvious to all parties, and a party, maybe a party, as an officer of the court, they have to admit that one of the factors they filed and that one of the facts they asserted in their complaint, they just say as officer of the court, we were wrong about that. We were given wrong information. That fact is no longer true, Your Honor. The court could then dismiss for lack of subject matter jurisdiction, couldn't it?
Well, if a party comes in, Your Honor, and says that we want to file an amended complaint because we've learned that...
I didn't ask you that question. I said the party comes in good faith as an officer of the court and goes, Your Honor, we asserted that paragraph 10. We now have to tell you as an officer of the court, we were just wrong about that. On good faith, we asserted it, but now we tell you that factor is not true. If that factor was critical to subject matter jurisdiction, couldn't the court just dismiss on its own motion of lack of subject matter jurisdiction?
Well, more than that, Your Honor,
just say I don't have subject
matter jurisdiction. More than that, Your Honor, I think as an officer of the court, I'd be bound to take a dismissal of my own suit. If I believe that the allegations of my complaint are in fact incorrect,
right,
and that I had no basis for asserting right, foreign sovereign immunity jurisdiction, I would be bound to come before the court and ask the court to dismiss my case because...
you might be bound by that, but what if before you ask to... If you ask to dismiss it, the court just goes, I have no subject matter jurisdiction, and I dismiss it on my own motion. You might be bound to do that, but you aren't telling me that the court couldn't dismiss for lack of subject matter jurisdiction once they found out that fact, jurisdictional fact, not to be true.
The court would dismiss, but it would be dismissing not through the lens of 12b-6, Your Honor. But
I didn't. Nobody's ever. You keep adding that. I'm not adding that. It's after 12b-6.
Well, that's a motion for summary judgment, Your Honor.
You're telling me then that the only way the court could dismiss for lack of subject matter jurisdiction after a 12b6 motion is summary judgment?
No, the court could, if there's a motion to reconsider that ruling, again look at the complaint in order to determine whether or not.
But a court, but either way, you're saying that a court would have to wait for a party to move?
If they came to the court's attention that the allegations of the complaint were incorrect somehow.
Right.
The court would be ruling that as a matter of law, and I'm not certain what aspect of it, but let's say it was Iraq was the wrong party.
Right.
Iraq is the wrong party here. So that when it's doing that, it's not looking at the allegations of the complaint.
So what vehicle would the court be using? I'm asking you, what vehicle would it? You said summary judgment motion.
I think that would be the appropriate vehicle.
You think that's the only vehicle?
Well, I think that's what the rules provide for, Your Honor. That's what's that is there. That in fact a 12B1 can be converted to. In fact, the rules specifically provide that a 12B1, when an affirmative matter is brought before the court, can be converted into a Rule 56.
I know they can be. Of course, it can be.
And I think that's the simple vehicle.
But that's at the time of the decision. That's at the time of the decision on that motion, isn't it?
Yes, but the court can always find that, based on affirmative matter, that there is here a basis to dismiss this complaint.
Let me go back to just the question I was asking. So do you believe that if, in fact, this court found there is jurisdiction in this case, subject matter jurisdiction in this case, right, do you think that binds both parties for the duration of the matter in the D.C. court?
Yes, unless there's a motion to reconsider that's filed before the D.C. court that has valid basis.
But absent that, a determination by this court that there's subject matter jurisdiction means that in the D.C. courts there is subject matter jurisdiction.
That's correct.
All the way to a final judgment.
Reconsider. Yes.
Okay. Anything else? Thank you very much. Thank you. Mr. Riley, save some time.
Thank you, everybody. Answer a couple of questions that came up during that argument. First, Judge Osteen, you had asked a question about whether the jurisdictional question was bound up in the merits and therefore had to be deferred, or whether the presumption applies at the jurisdictional stage or only at the merits stage. And the answer from Mr. Pavich was that it only applies at the merits stage, which is incorrect. And I would cite to the court the foremost McKesson case from the D.C. Circuit, which holds very plainly that the presumption of juridical separateness of government entities applies to the jurisdictional as well as the substantive stages of the case and ought to be determined now.
That's from the D.C. Circuit?
Yes, it is, Your Honor.
It doesn't bind us.
No, it does not. However, I would cite it to the court as guidance here. There are not many issues that are comprehensively decided by any circuit under the FISA.
What if we saw the presumption differently? We saw the Fourth Circuit sees it the way that Mr. Pavich sees it. Which would we apply then in this case? What you just cited or our precedent over a case that's going to end up...
If there was a contrary decision from this court, I think this court would be bound, this panel would be bound to rule in that way. I agree with that. Now, another question that had come up was whether this was a motion for summary judgment. What we had made was not a second motion before the district judge, but supplemental submission to the court, which the judge in his ruling, in fact, said did not convert it to a motion for summary judgment, but he said the court views Iraq's claim that Wyoke sued the wrong party as part of its challenge to this court's subject matter jurisdiction, which is properly considered at this stage. So he did not treat it as a motion for summary judgment. Likewise, this court in the Velasco case, which we cite in our opening brief at page 6, states as follows, when a defendant challenges subject matter jurisdiction via Rule 12b1 motion to dismiss, the district court may regard the pleadings as mere evidence on the issue and may consider evidence outside the pleadings without converting the proceedings to one for summary judgment. I think that conclusively answers that procedural question.
So under your analysis, we should initially determine who's the proper party and then move into the jurisdictional analysis?
Yes. And that's very important here because the Bansek case teaches exactly that, that you've got to find the proper party first. Again, if you remember, the Bansek case at the district court level was a who's the proper party, who has standing to assert these claims and counterclaims.
And if the court should find that the question of proper parties bound up in the merits determination and then goes forward to determine jurisdiction, what's really been determined other than the merits are bound up in the substance and need right. to be all determined summary judgment stage or the trial, whichever.
Yes, and I appreciate the practical consideration that the court is raising is one I think that Judge Trenga wrestled with as well. However, I think Judge Trenga stopped short of the kind of factual inquiry that needed to be made. When the facts put in doubt the status of the proper party and also the status of whether sufficient facts have been pleaded to assert subject matter jurisdiction, the court, district court, must stop first and make a more complete factual inquiry.
That's really where I was going with my questions. My question is, and I think you see the status of this case at this point different than the other side. You think the question of subject matter jurisdiction is only on the issues as they were in front of the court, and some of these issues, facts hadn't even been shown to the court yet. Is that how you see it?
Some of these facts had not been taken into account by the district court and certainly hadn't been viewed. I mean, and your question, Your Honor, about subject matter jurisdiction, for example, being a different decision than summary judgment, I totally agree with
you. I know,
with
I you. Thought you would.
I have a simple example.
No, just wait for a second, because yeah. I understand your yeah. posture of the case. You think that the facts have not, you think the court, by just delaying the decision, has not dealt with the facts that you think are critical. So yes. you believe that once the court knows those facts, the court could find then, knowing these facts, there is no subject matter jurisdiction.
Yes, Your Honor, I believe that to be so.
But your argument, and following up on that, your mm-hmm. argument is that there is no law of the case because there is no finding of subject matter jurisdiction?
I guess I'm arguing from my perspective. Again, we were talking about the prisms through which we view issues. My understanding of the law of the case is it is a rule of discretion that guides the court's discretion in not disturbing issues that have been previously decided and leaving things settled that ought to be remain settled, but that it doesn't bind the court's authority to reconsider when that's in the interest of justice.
No, it's a higher standard. Well, it's clear error and manifest injustice. That's a pretty high standard, but that's going a little bit beyond my question. My question is, what do we are you taking issue with the fact that we have a determination as the subject matter jurisdiction? Because if we don't, if it's your position that we don't, then there is no law of the case. But if it's your position that we do, then the law of the case does come into play with the consequent changes in the standard of review that accompany that.
I do understand that to be a posture we find ourselves in, that there is the potential that if this court were to rule, for example, that the district court did not err.
Okay, can you specifically answer my question?
I'm struggling to, Your Honor, and I'll have to say this has been one of the most exciting oral arguments I've had in the sense of the court's questions and really challenging, and I'm struggling with each of these issues. And if you could frame your question again, Your Honor, it would help me.
Is it your position that the district court has or has not ruled on the question of subject matter jurisdiction?
The district court here has ruled on subject matter jurisdiction by taking as plausible the allegations and ruling no farther than that.
What one does in the 12b6, and I understand the differences in subject matter jurisdiction coming up, the issues relying on issues of fact and the allegations in the complaint. But is it your position that that Judge Trango ruled on the question of subject matter jurisdiction and found that subject matter jurisdiction existed based on the facts as alleged in the complaint?
Yes, Your Honor. To answer that directly, yes. Now, let me answer the point about jurisdiction and why that's not a summary judgment ruling. For example,
how could he have done that, though, if he never made a finding with respect to the proper part, but simply deferred that to later? If that's the first step of your jurisdictional analysis.
I think it is. I think it was error to make that judgment in that way. That is, to defer this issue. This issue needed to be decided up front, was presented up front.
How do you answer Judge Duncan's question, yes, he made a finding, when the first step of your analysis he deferred to trial?
But that, I guess I was reciting literally what he did. I'm not arguing, obviously, that it was correct. What he did by one of the errors was procedural, and that is deferring this issue for factual adjudication later, which essentially nullifies the potential sovereign immunity, which is, as this court teaches in the Velasco case again, is immunity from the burdens of litigation, not merely from liability. But if, for example, if this was a diversity case and the court were to find that one of the parties was no longer, was not diverse at the outset of the case, the court would say, I'm dismissing this case for lack of subject matter jurisdiction and I'm not reaching the merits. It's not a Rule 56 motion for summary judgment.
Summary judgment is a determination on the merits. It wouldn't be, if a court found out a jurisdictional fact was in error, do you understand my posture? But after the 12b6 motion?
Yes.
Because I'm just trying to set up a scenario where it becomes clear that a needed, necessary fact for jurisdiction, although asserted in the complaint, we now know it does not exist.
Yes.
The court, that would not be a determination of under Rule 56. That would be no determination on the merits. That would just be a dismissal for lack of subject matter jurisdiction.
Correct, Your Honor. And again, as the rules teach, 12H3, lack of subject matter jurisdiction. If the court determines at any time that it lacks subject matter jurisdiction, the court must dismiss the action. It's a non-merits dismissal.
I thought that the district court considered the core functions test.
The court did, and we submit that that is error because
I understand that, but it's going to how that he did not make a finding as to the proper party.
The gist of the court's ruling was that to apply the FISA provision, the definition of a foreign state, and say that for the purposes of the FISA, there is no distinction between a foreign state and a political subdivision.
But that's a finding. That's a finding as to the proper party, isn't it? I'm not saying that.
Correct.
Obviously, you're taking issue with that.
Yes.
But
yes.
I was going back to why you think that finding was made.
I understand your question better now. He did make the finding that Iraq could be sued as alleged here, but he remarked several times during the oral argument itself that isn't that just a decision on the merits? It could be that it turns out that Iraq is not liable for this contract.
again, right, deferring the proper party issue to the merits adjudication and saying
because
that it
was
bound up
in... Because it was more of a fact-based determination.
Correct. Right. But as a fact-based issue, again, it's the district court's duty under the FISA to engage in sufficient fact-finding at the threshold to assure itself that it has both, in this instance, the proper party and subject matter jurisdiction and cannot defer these issues.
But under your scenario, you would never be able to obtain a 12b6 ruling in a FISA case. Because it would always be fact dependent.
There may be situations under, and again, our motion was made under Rule 12b1 for lack of subject, which is viewed many in many respects like a 12b6.
Yeah.
No. I understood exactly where your question was directing me. The facts as alleged would be examined by the district court. The court can receive other evidence, and in this instance, actually question counsel for YO very critically, and was obtained concessions that certain of their allegations were actually not.
But why couldn't you allege in such a case, mm-hmm, facts necessary for jurisdiction? Why couldn't you allege it? Allege who they were, the contracting party, who was in the contract, they were responsible, that here are the activities. Why couldn't you? It could be wrong, but you could certainly allege that in a complaint.
It could be, and to an extent that's what occurred here. But under the Rux case, for in particular, for the jurisdictional analysis, there have to be sufficient facts pleaded, not conclusory allegations, and certainly ones that the district court is...
But I'm saying, but you could plead them.
Yes.
Whatever you think was necessary could be pleaded by a party. You might then come in and ask for either additional fact-finding under one, or else you could make some other motion, but there's no problem to properly asserting and alleging such an action, is there?
No,
in the 12b6,
absolutely.
To withstand a 12b6 motion.
Correct. Well, 12b6 dealing with the merits, or 12b1 dealing with jurisdiction. Absolutely, Your Honor. And I think that sort of pleading is attempted all the time, particularly under the FISA, to identify the facts that would show the applicability of the commercial
set. Your argument isn't that it can't be done. It's just that it wasn't done properly in this case.
Yes, Your Honor. That's correct.
Anything else? Thank you very much.
Thank you very much,
Your Honor. We'll step down to Greek counsel and go directly to the next case.